Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are on an open line and will be for the duration of today's conference. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I will now turn the call over to Mr. Sean Brooks. You may begin.
Good morning, and I'd like to welcome everyone online and in the room to the next installation of the CHARM series of talks. Before I go further, I'd like to remind everyone that you can mute your phone by dialing *6 or whatever other mechanism you might have on your own phone. We have today Dr. Sami Asmar speaking about the recent results from the radio science experiment on Enceladus. He will be giving a talk that has contributions also from Dr. Asil Anantawi, who is the IS for RSS.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I thought so. The investigation scientist for the radio science subsystem on Cassini. Dr. Asmar has been at JPL for a while, since 1985, when he came on as a radio science engineer. He got his master's in physics from Occidental College, taking engineering courses at Caltech. Make sure, correct me if I'm wrong. Began here as a radio science engineer. He worked on the Ulysses missions. He also worked with Mars Pathfinder, Mars Global Surveyor. He received his master's in physics from Cal State Northridge in 1990.
Don't worry about that.
And he also then went back again and got a master's in geophysics and space physics from UCLA and received a PhD from UCLA in 2004. Is that right? He's currently working as a member of the Cassini Radio Science Subsystem and has been involved with the investigations we'll be discussing today. So with that, I'd like to give you Dr. Asmar, no further ado.
Please. Great. So I'm one of the co-authors on a recent paper that made a big, there was a lot of buzz around it in the journal Science titled The Gravity Field and Interior Structure of Enceladus. And the primary reason for that tension is that one of the conclusions is that the gravity data supports the presence of a liquid sea ocean, although not necessarily global, under a layer of ice on Enceladus. So this usually, whenever you find liquid water somewhere in the solar system, people pay attention because of the possibility for presence of life and related concepts. So we had a big press conference and a lot of attention has been covered in the media. And the reason I say this is that when we asked Professor Dave Stevenson from Caltech if he would co-present this CHARM seminar, he said, is there anybody who still has not heard about this? I guess he's been contacted by every media outlet in the world. So as a result of that approach, we had to dig deeper into the author list, and then they settled on me. The primary data analysis was actually done by the lead gravity scientist, Luciano Ies, who's a professor at the University of Rome, La Sapienza, and one of his graduate students, Marta Parisi. Luciano is the first author on the science paper, but we borrowed slides from Marta's EGU presentations that Estelle and I added our own material to. So I kind of left her as the first author in terms of the slides. As it turns out, the timing is bad for Estelle. She's now in the middle of an ORT for an upcoming bistatic radar experiment, another branch of Cassini radio science. So she might or might not be able to join us. So with that, we're going to proceed to the first slide.
First slide, the second slide on the PDF, which is available on the CHARM website.
So this is a background slide about the field in, that we call radio science, just in case, because I don't know who typically calls into these seminars. And if you have, you know, a lot of background, a lot of familiarity with radio science, we define it as the utilization of radio links or telecom links that are present between the spacecraft and ground stations on Earth. And we examine changes, sometimes very small changes, minute changes, in the phasor frequency, amplitude, sometimes polarizations of these radio signals to investigate a host of geophysical and solar system phenomena that can be grouped into atmospheres, interiors, ring surfaces, and then we get more exotic in solar corona, comets, fundamental physics, such as tests. So testing the general theory of relativity, which was done actually very nicely and successfully in the Cassini-Cruz phase. So a lot of people hear of radio science in terms of atmospheric occultations, which is the first category. And what we're going to talk about today is the second, which is planetary interior structure, which is derived from measuring the gravity data. So with that, on the next slide, I titled Gravity and Planetary Interiors. So the objective of any gravity experiment, whether it's on Cassini or other missions, and we do this on practically every deep space planetary mission, is to measure the mass and mass distribution inside the object, the body. So typically, if it's a quick flyby, we can measure the mass. If we have multiple flybys, we can start getting an idea of a mass distribution. If it's an orbiter, we generate a detailed gravity field, which has mass or density variations as a function of latitude and longitude on the planet. So we'll be talking about what parameters and what language we use in terms of circle harmonic expansion. I wanted to mention I'm the project scientist on the GRAIL mission, which has concluded the mission dedicated to gravity does nothing else but gravity at the moon. And in terms of the results, it's a dual spacecraft that have been in orbit for a total of 6 months around the moon. We got a gravity field in terms of spherical harmonic expansion past 1,000 degree in order. And that's an incredibly high resolution that's unmatched, unparalleled anywhere in the solar system. So if that's one extreme of getting high resolution data. This is, in terms of Enceladus, is closer to the other extreme where you get a couple of flybys, three in this case, so we can get degree two, degree three, can try to squeeze some information on degree four as opposed to some other planets. By the way, Earth, from the GRACE mission, we know the gravity field to 120, which is not even as well as the moon. But the catch here is that in the case of Earth, there's time-varying gravity. There are things that move, like atmospheres and water and oceans, and that kind of add additional constraints that don't exist at the moon. But speaking of oceans, we should come back to Enceladus. So we using gravity data, as we'll explain later today, we can constrain the model of the interior structure and start inferring information such as presence of differentiation, core, mantle, crust, liquid, oceans, and the like. And this, so the combination of gravity and magnetism in the case of Europa that has led to the assumption that Europa has an ocean. Also, gravity helps us improve the orbits and the ephemerides, and it utilizes Doppler and sometimes ranging. So Doppler, which is in units of velocity, typically, and ranging is in units of distance, we get accuracy of a tenth of a hundredth of a millimeter per second at X-band and even better at Ka-band. I just want to stress that this is really a very small number. So to know that an object like the Cassini spacecraft has changed its velocity by one hundredth of a millimeter per second when it's about a million kilometers across the solar system is, to me, an incredible engineering accomplishment that, credit goes to the design of the spacecraft, its radio system, and, of course, the deep space network, which is the bigger section, bigger element of our instrument.
If I'm doing my unit conversion correctly, that's 10 microns per second.
Yes. So that's an average number.
Okay.
And you'll see, we'll see the actual numbers for the case of Enceladus in the 30 micron per second range, but this is a typical number. Next slide, please. So this is taken from another mission. It just shows a line of sight velocity. So by the nature of the Doppler effect, we're sensitive to the changes in the velocity along the line of sight. So if this is the spacecraft pointing its antenna to a deep space network on Earth, and it moves in this line of sight, then we're very sensitive to changes in the velocity. If it happens to move in and out of the screen, that's 90 degrees, then we're not sensitive. That's in the cross plane, and we're less sensitive. So typically, obviously, the motion is a combination of that, so it's a cosine effect where we pick up information along the component of the vector of the line of sight.
We're now on slide 5.
Which has a very nice, big, fancy equation, which will, I usually joke, we're going to spend the next 40 minutes deriving, but I won't say that. So this is an equation of the gravitational potential that governs this business, and it's actually written in terms of the spherical harmonic expansion coefficients, and then we show some normalization coefficients. So people talk about C22, S22, C1, S1, J2. These are the C's and the S's in the equation. So the GM over R, the first term, is when you can only pick up the mass of an object. And the remaining terms are when you can start getting higher resolution and start getting what we call higher order terms of the gravitational potential. All right, move on. This is really intended to impress on you that getting the raw data and just knowing the Doppler effect and the changes in the velocity is not the whole story. We have to calibrate and understand so many different effects and parameters that this is very complicated business, and there are very specialized and dedicated software such as the JPL's ODP, Orbit Determination Program, and now the next generation called Monty, that account for so many things. And that's why they have to be institutionally supported. They're just so complex. And they are the primary tool for navigating the mission. So we utilize navigation tools, and physics is obviously the same. So by way of example, and you can take your time looking at this, but at my far right, there's a box that says trajectory models. So we have to understand the planet's ephemeris, account for the Earth's rotation, including polar motion, nutation, precession, tidal effects, atmospheres, the station location, and how the station location can change as a function of time, and a whole bunch of information about the spacecraft, state vector and attitude, relativistic effects, solar pressure, and on and on. So that's why the analysis takes time, and that's why it has to be done with a lot of precision, because we end up dealing with very small numbers, very small effects, and any one of these effects, if mishandled, can ruin the measurements, essentially. All right. You normally take questions, allow for questions any time?
I think we try to take them for the end.
Yeah.
But maybe if you slow down at the end of each slide and allow someone to
have to... Yeah, so I just want to say, feel free to jump in, if questions that you might forget by the end, you can ask now. This slide shows...
Yeah, this is Nancy Cooper from Bainbridge Island, Washington, and I want to know what the momentum dumps are.
Momentum dumps is a phenomenon where the spacecraft, as it moves and turns and rotates, momentum is stored in its reaction wheels, and those then reach a limit and have to be released and dumped. So this causes a dynamic disturbance when we unload the it's called momentum desaturation, I believe. When that happens, that's a big dynamical effect or a disruption that disturbs gravity and navigation data. So gravity scientists and navigators would have to know exactly when the momentum dumps take place, so that we can exclude those few minutes from our data, because they are a disturbance that kind of overwhelms our measurements.
So that it's help? A spacecraft phenomenon.
It's on the spacecraft side.
Great. Thank you.
Is that angular momentum that's dumped? Or?
Thrusters. Using thrusters.
Yes, using clusters. And they
oh,
did it.
Okay.
Okay. So this slide shows just other classical results in the world of gravity science. On the left is a gravity map of Mars from various orbiters, primarily Mars Global Surveyor, which lasted 10 years and acquired a lot of gravity data. You can see, so the blue is gravity low and the high is gravity red, and immediately both your mind and eye want to jump to topography low and topography high. And this is where it gets interesting geophysically. So you can see the big Valles Marineris, the big Grand Canyon on Mars, which is this blue segment there. So that happens to be obviously low topography because we know it's a big hole in the ground, and also low gravity. So these are consistent. And you see some of the mountains are high and, you know, in the gravity and high in the topography. And some of the black regions, I think, are just saturated. They're just way too high. But where it gets interesting, and I'm not showing that here, is when you look at the topography and it's high, but you look at the gravity at the same location and it's low or neutral or it's average. So then what's going on? Why is this big mountain doesn't have a gravity signal? And that's because of an effect called compensation. So planets like to reach hydrostatic equilibrium through hydrostatic compensation. So if the mountain or the topography was formed when the planet was young and still warm enough, it compensates for it with mushier subsurface material, and you get a net zero gravity signal while the mountain is seen in the topography. But if it formed when it was it has cooled down and it cannot compensate, then you see gravity high. So right away, you can start essentially dating the birth of these mountains. There's also the opposite phenomenon where there might be a plane with no features in the images or the topography, but you look at the gravity and there's a high signal. And again, another subsurface effect, so there might be something buried beneath the surface of higher densities, such as impactor or magma that's froze. And you cannot see that in either topography or imagery. So right away, it tells you that gravity is one way to start peering subsurface and peeling the layers of the onion from just below the crust to a possible core, all the way to a possible core. And speaking of possible cores, this other image is the Galilean satellites, including Europa, and how scientists have come up with this bulk distribution and differentiation models that show in many cases that there's a high-density solid core, a mantle and a crust, and also in some couple of cases a potential for liquid oceans. So again, these are not Cassini results, but classic results in gravity science. We should, of course, be updating these with GRAIL and Dawn at Vesta and more on this interest.
Question here.
Yes.
On that slide 7, you have two images of Mars with the colors with the gravity anomaly.
It's just two hemispheres.
It's just the two hemispheres. Okay. I was wondering if one of them was already corrected for elevation or not.
No, sorry, but I should have explained that. Sometimes people plot these in different ways, different projections. So if you want to keep them circular, you have to put the two hemispheres separately. Some people like to have looking down on from the poles, but this is just the two different hemispheres. So now we get to Enceladus, the sixth largest moon of Saturn. Its typical semi-major axis distance is about 240,000 kilometers, and it moves at an average velocity in its orbit of about 12.5 kilometers per second. Its orbit is not exactly a circle. It deviates from that in an eccentricity by a small amount of 5,000. And its orbit is also not exactly in the plane of its mother planet. It's inclined by about a hundredth of a degree. It's relatively small, 252 kilometers as a mean radius, and it's relatively low density, 1.6 gram per centimeter cube. So the big thing about Enceladus, and this, the background image shows, is that Cassini cameras discovered these water vapor jets coming out from the south polar regions in 2005. So that generated a lot of attention. And go ahead, next slide. And we're making a contribution to understanding what causes that. To get to understand that a little better, I wanted to talk about tidal forces. Again, not knowing who all is on the line, I'll just take a minute to explain that. It happens that I had a graphic for a Titan explaining the tidal effects as opposed to Enceladus. So this shows that Titan also has eccentric orbits, so sometimes it comes close to Saturn and sometimes it's far away from Saturn. So, and it's also spinning. So as you can see, we try to make the graphics exaggerate the effect. The gravity of Saturn pulls on Titan, so as the orbit comes close and moves out further, then the tidal forces cause the bulge to move and always point to Saturn. So and this is why I wanted to be in the room with some people so I can use my hands.
Yeah, that's a great slide.
So if it's ideally spherical, but you're Saturn and you're pulling on it, it's going to do like this, but as it rotates, then the bulge is going to do this. So the net effect is that stuff on the inside is being moved around due to these tidal forces acting on it, and this generates heat, which is the bottom line. So there's tidal sources of energy. Tidal heating is the term that people use. So when you want to explain why is there liquid water, you know, how did the ice melt? Where did the heat come from? The most common explanation nowadays is the tidal effect, the effect of the forces from the mother planet, in this case Saturn, on it as it orbits in a non-circular orbit. All right. Next slide, Mr. Sean.
Okay, we are now on slide 10.
So this is another graphic from Saturn, from a science paper from a year and a half ago, where we came to the same conclusion that Titan itself had the liquid layer by the same method that we're going to describe with Enceladus. So there's a pattern there. Titan, Enceladus, previously Europa, and so on. So apparently a lot of water in the icy outer solar system. Okay, next slide. So more specifically to the technicalities of the Enceladus observations, we had three gravity flybys. We had numerous flybys of Enceladus, but by the nature of the Saturn, the Cassini, science planning and instrument negotiations and which instruments are going to point to Enceladus and so on, not every flyby is a gravity flyby where we can point the Huygens antenna to Earth and collect coherent two-way Doppler data. So we managed to get three of those in the configuration that we like. And they're designated E9, 12, and 19, with E9 taking place in April 2010, then November 2010, and then more recently May of 2012. And the spacecraft altitude during these flybys are also shown: 100 kilometers on the first, 48 on the second, and 70 kilometers on the third. One of the things about the equation I showed earlier is that even though I showed the potential, which is 1 over r, the force, which is the derivative, is 1 over r squared. So the closer we are to the object, the more sensitive we are to the gravitational forces by 1 over r squared. So if you drop the altitude by a factor of 2, you improve the sensitivity by a factor of 4. So as you can see, 100 kilometers is pretty close distance, but it was even much better when we were half a distance at 48 and some fraction at 70 kilometers. We also, as it turns out, we covered different latitudes, and there's a color scheme where we show E9 was mostly in the southern hemisphere of Enceladus, E12 was mostly in the north, and back E19 was mostly in the south. So that kind of helps if you're trying to get the global image, which we actually have indeed created the global image I'll be showing. Another important parameter for us is where is the sun? And that's the SEP angle, sun-earth probe. We like the sun to be away from where we're looking because it introduces noise to the Doppler data, the quality of our observation. So a number like 141 degree SEP is excellent. That means the sun is practically behind you as you look at towards Saturn. And Enceladus was still reasonably 54 degrees, but, you know, not as good. And then if you're close to 180 degrees, that means the sun is exactly behind you. So anything over 100 is good. So that's why in the planning we always worry about the SEP angle, where's the sun when we're observing. So it turns out the spacecraft velocity was on the order of 6 to 7 kilometers per second during these flybys. All right. So even though the spacecraft velocity was about 6 kilometers per second, this is the delta. This is the error on that for each of the observations. So that's say 6 plus or minus 0.003 kilometers per second. So we have these in detail for the three flybys, E9, E12, and E19, and for the three degree gravity field that we'll be talking about some more. So for the monopole, or if you're just measuring mass by itself, it's called degree zero, and then for the degree two, which is really a characterization of the flattening of the object, and degree three, which tells you more about where the bulge is due to the tidal effects, we show the details just to impress that we have reasonably low uncertainty numerically, and the SNR basically of the data is high confidence. Next slide, please. Okay, one of the elephants in the room we have to address is that we actually flew through the plume, and that introduced an effect in the Doppler observation. Then, in this case, it's a corruption of the Doppler observation because Doppler here reflects the measurement of motion and forces, and the medium in the intervening space should be understood and calibrated out. So typically, there is no plume, and the media we have to worry about is interplanetary plasma, you know, effect of the sun in the quote vacuum space, the Earth's atmosphere, the Earth's ionosphere. But now this is a case where we have to add to that the plume itself at Enceladus. So, but we did that. Luckily, there were two models of plume density. One is attributed to Tenyshev, and one is attributed to Dong. And they came up with two similar but not identical density models. And so we found where our measurement falls between the two models, and we accounted for that. So in fact, the science paper has a nice paragraph that describes how we did that. But we are, I want to say, 100% confident that we've accounted for this effect, and it's not corrupting the gravity interpretation.
So what you're saying is that you've got two different bounds on the plume parameter, and
correct,
the results are robust against those bounds.
Correct, correct. So people who might have done gravity at Mars, an analogous example would be the drag measurements from the atmosphere of Mars itself. If the spacecraft is low enough, again, you're measuring dynamical effects, forces, and velocities, and you start feeling the atmosphere pushing back on the solar panel of a Mars orbiter, that's a drag. So you have to understand the density of the atmosphere and account for that. This is not exactly the same, but kind of the closest analogy I can think of.
You're saying that flying through the plume changes the plume itself?
No, it changes the dynamics of the velocity, the spacecraft. I mean the...
This slows the spacecraft down as you're flying through the plume?
It essentially slows the spacecraft down, and the material corrupts the electromagnetic quality of the radio signal.
Okay.
So how do we really do this? Cassini has probably the best radio system ever. It's because it has X-band transponder, which is at 8.48 gigahertz, roughly, and for telecommunication and navigation, and was added a second radio, second transponder at Ka band, which was actually an Italian space agency contribution, and that's at 32 to 34 gigahertz. As it happens, the Ka translator, the KAT, was used very nicely in the cruise phase, but prior to arriving in the Saturn orbital phase, it died. There was an anomaly. So we could not get coherent Ka up, Ka down at the Saturn system, but we were able to use half of it, so we can have X up, X down, as well as X up, Ka down. So the Ka down we receive is coherent with an X-band uplink. I don't know if you are keeping track. It's a little hard to understand. But the bottom line is that this gives us two simultaneous downlinks, one at X-band and one at Ka-band, although they're both coherent with the same uplink. And the value of this is when you have two downlinks, then the dispersive media, any charged particle effect on the downlink, can be calibrated just by simple differentiation of the two links, because it's a function of wavelength. So when you have two wavelengths, one at X and one at Ka, you can remove the dispersive media. So this adds just even more validation to the X-band coherent data. So again, the data accuracy is in the tenths or hundreds of millimeters per second at 60-second integration time. But also, still on this slide, I alluded earlier that the DSN is the bigger half of our instrument. It is indeed a science instrument because it transmits the signal, and all Cassini does is bounce the signal back to the DSN. And the DSN receives it, and the data are actually generated at the DSN. The Doppler observable is generated on the ground, not on the spacecraft. So we literally get no data from the spacecraft. We have no bits or bytes to negotiate in terms of telemetry, packages, things of that nature. Data are generated in the DSN. We just functionally think of the spacecraft as a mirror that bounces back these radio signals. But that's where all the crux of the science is. All right, next slide.
Okay, we're now on slide 15.
Also, in terms of the DSN, we have other constraints. We talked about the sun-earth probe angle, the constraints. We also don't want the DSN antenna to be pointed too low on the horizon. So the elevation angle is another constraint. So these three slides for the three solid flybys show where the three complexes, the letter C, M, and G stands for Canberra, Madrid, and Goldstone, or Australia, Spain, and California, where our DSN stations are located, and how high or low on the horizon we were. So if I pick that's 11 as well, the upper right one, the triangle shows the closest approach was over Goldstone and was probably between 30 and 40 degree elevation, just roughly. Doesn't matter. You don't have to strain your eyes finding that number. But that shows that that's reasonable. As long as it's over 10, 15 degree elevation. And the reason for that is if you're pointed low, you pick up more of the Earth atmosphere, and that's another corruption to the data that have to be calibrated better. Sometimes we get lucky and we get overlapping stations, and we can get the measurements at multiple DSN stations, and that adds more to the validity of our data. All right, barring any questions, so far, I'll move on. Okay. This is the actual solution that comes out of MONSI, or the ODP, or the modern version of the orbit determination program, that gives you what we call the Doppler residuals. So residuals meaning when you've taken out every known effect that I showed in that complicated table earlier, including momentum dumps. When you take out all the known effects and you've done all your calibrations, what is left? So that's on the y-axis, but it's too small to read. But the legend shows that the RMS for E9 was, again, 28 micrometers per second, a very small number. And it was same neighborhood, 27, went up to 37 for whatever the conditions are, sun-Earth probe angle or Earth atmosphere, whatever, we have slightly higher noise. But really, this is still a very small number. And then tenths of millions of a meter per second. And this shows the closest approach, and the color code, I believe, is still the different stations, Madrid, Goldstone, and Canberra. So I wanted to impress on you the quality of the data from actual results from the output of our software. Next slide, please. The term multi-arc is used here. Navigators are familiar with it. Because data could be broken up from station to station, or between momentum dumps that causes a break in the arc, you can do a solution for single arcs, one at a time, which gives you certain results, or eventually you have to throw everything in the blender and get the multi-arc solution. So when we develop high enough confidence in the multi-arc solution, that's what we prefer because that gives you a bigger picture. So that's what that means. So these are the global parameters. To really understand this better, you have to take these coefficients and go back to the equation. So C20, people like to call J2 for some historical reason. Then you got your higher C's and your higher S's. And so these are the estimated values in the second column, and they're actually times a million. And the formal uncertainty. So you can see that the two biggest numbers are C2 and C22, or J2 and C22. And the other ones are much smaller. And the reason this matters is that in geophysics, people like to take the ratio, which is the bottom row in this table, the ratio of J2 to C22. If a body was in complete hydrostatic equilibrium, it has on its own reached hydrostatic equilibrium, this number would be 10 over 3, just by the laws of physics. And if it deviates from that ratio, then it's not exactly in hydrostatic equilibrium. And that's what we find here. For Enceladus, it deviates from 10 over 3, which is like 3.333 something, by 5%. So it's mildly in not hydrostatic equilibrium, which is one of the important conclusions of the paper that can lead to bigger things and eventually lead you to things as an ocean. All right. Next slide, please. So what is the implication of that table to the gravity field and the reduction of interior structure? One is that they're dominated by the quadrupole terms J2 and C22, as I showed, and the other numbers are significantly smaller. And there's a remarkable asymmetry between the northern and the southern hemispheres of Enceladus, which I had not appreciated until we started this investigation. It turns out that in both gravity and topography, there's an asymmetry north versus south. It's relatively small, so looking at the picture, you can't really tell. Some objects you can tell, like Vesta, the asteroid. You can clearly tell just from looking at the picture. There's north versus south asymmetry. The Dione has a ridge that kind of makes you think there's some asymmetry. In Enceladus, you can't tell because the effect is small. Nevertheless, the data show that. And like I said, it deviates, although mildly, in the order of 5-6% from the hydrostatic equilibrium condition. And this small number might be small because of compensation that has taken effect over geological timescale. There's also a small but not negligible degree 2 contribution, and we'll get to what that means. But also the another important term here is the moment of inertia, the MOI. Again, if we go back to basic laws of physics, if an object is completely homogeneous, so since all this was made of cheese and nothing but cheese all the way from the crust to the core, the moment of inertia would be 0.4. If it's made of lead, which is much heavier than cheese but still homogeneous, the moment of inertia would be 0.4. So for any homogeneous object, the moment of inertia should be 0.4. And if it's less than that, that implies differentiation. So there are layers, core, mantle, crust, and so on. So we do get, obviously, a number that's less than that, as we get for most of these objects. So none of them are just one solid rock that's homogeneous. So that means it is differentiated. And then it gets tricky, and you often need other inputs, other physical or chemical or geological sources of information to understand more as to how it is differentiated. So from our knowledge to date on Enceladus, we concluded that this moment of inertia is compatible with a core that is of low density, small core, and a mantle of 60 kilometers thickness and density that's close to water, or actually ice. So we're going to elaborate on that. Any questions so far? All right. I joked earlier that we actually did a global map of gravity of Enceladus, and that's what you're looking at the left side. We took the three flybys, and we did the global circle harmonic expansion that kind of mixed up data, spread the information globally, and obviously insufficient resolution from three flybys to get a high resolution map. But you can generally see where the highs and lows are on the body. And the image on the left-hand side is just the uncertainties that's associated with that. So here, this now gets us to the crux of the ocean. If you look at the South Pole, it's blue. That means there's a clear gravity deficiency, gravity low signal at the South Pole. Okay, next slide. So we'll see what that means slowly.
Slide 20.
So this is the slide that shows Enceladus opened up, and you can actually see a core, an ice mantle, and thin crust, and our interpretation of a sea at the South Pole. And we think the sea extends up to latitude 50 from 50 south. It could conceivably be global, covers the whole body, but our data does not necessarily support that, but I think it does not preclude that. But from our data, we can detect it in this configuration. So it turns out, as I said, that the there's a gravity deficiency, low gravity signal at the South Pole, but this has to be compensated by something. And it turns out that usually when you get a liquid and you take a solid form, the solid form is more dense, but water is the only substance where it's the opposite, where when you freeze it, it's lower density. So for this to be compensated, we need something of higher density, and that's why water makes sense. So we inferred the presence of a liquid water reservoir at these depths, and I believe we said 30 kilometers below the ice, but that number will come up again. Based on these considerations, the estimated gravity anomaly is not large enough to explain 1.2 kilometer depression in the topography. So like I said, both topography and gravity show this north-south asymmetry. So from the topography, the south pole is 1.2 kilometers shorter than the north pole. And the estimated gravity anomaly does not explain that by itself. So you need to put back material to compensate for that. So that's why water makes sense. And we knew that this region, there's heat output, and we saw that blooms. I mean, that's actually the killer. When you see liquid water coming out, and kind of helps the guesswork. And due to the tidal effects that I took time to explain, there's a decoupling from the ice shell to the solid core. So for tides to kind of, for this bulge to be tracking Saturn due to tidal effects, need the lubricating layers to separate solid mantle from a solid core. And that could only be explained by water. So these three considerations kind of made it the most likely interpretation. Now, it's important to kind of be conservative here and say, first, it's not the only possible. Somebody might come up with another explanation. And gravity data, by its nature, is not unique, meaning that any number of configuration of material can give you the same gravity signal. You can have one part water, two parts ice, one part iron. You know, you could play with these things as long as the net effect has the same gravity signal, then that's your observation. So again, like I said, whenever you can, you try to bring in additional information from images, from geophysics, from geochemistry, from geology, to help you pin down among the family of choices that can give you the same gravity signal. So it's non-unique, but this, we did have other evidence, and it makes sense, but it can never be 100%. All right. So this shows if you had an ice shell, I guess here it says 10 kilometers thick. Let me read this to make sure I understand it. If we're talking about an 8-kilometer thickness of water or the ice, a liquid water layer, 8% denser than ice, 10 kilometers thickness. Okay, so this is the water layer is 10 kilometers thick. And you get cracks in the ice due to the tidal heating and the need for the energy to come out. Then you get the gas, the water, and ice grains coming out in the form of plumes. So, again, the region, we saw the plumes on the south pole, and our gravity data supports, now I prefer to call it a sea, as opposed to an ocean, because some people want to jump to an image of an ocean being global, and that's possible, but we're not claiming that. And the water ocean, is, as we show in the cartoon, is in direct contact with the rocky core and with the ice layer. So it is, again, the I call the lubricating layer that is necessary to have independent motion of two solid layers, namely the ice mantle and the mineral core. And that's how we basically concluded there's a sea, and people like that because and we should have made another graphic that shows little creatures because exobiology now, you know, is of interest. And observations like this are supporting proposals for future missions to Titan and Enceladus because these are the two we've studied and showed liquid subsurface layers. And this is basically the whole story, but let's see what other slides we have. Conclusion. So a very fitting interpretation, so not the only possible interpretation, but just makes a lot of sense. Of the Cassini gravity measurements is the presence of a regional liquid water, ocean, or sea underneath the icy crust at the south polar region of the mountains. So these water pockets function as a tank that supplies a misspelled jet made out of water particles. So the tidal heating causes, over geological time scale, the ice to liquefy and add to the tank. But this cannot go on forever because eventually energy is released. That's why not the entire ice shell has melted. So it's input and output of energy, which leads again to a potentially habitable environment that could have been found in an unexpected region in the solar system, where the energy needed to produce liquid water from ice is not provided by solar radiation alone, because it's so far away from the sun, but by internal sources. And the greater concentration of water beneath the surface of the top wall, inferred from this gravity data, fits our understanding of how Enceladus has kind of geologically evolved and how it's currently active to the point where the camera captured plumes in action. And I think that kind of kills an hour of your time.
Okay, so great. I'd like to thank our speaker, Dr. Esmar, again, open it up with some questions, and I'd like to start with at least two, sort of a twofold question. In terms of constraining what's going on at the North Pole, it would seem that passes over the North Pole would help you do that. Are we going to get any more passes, radio science passes over the North Pole? And if not, just how many more radio science passes of Enceladus do we have left?
I anticipate the question, left a Celan email to see if she's involved in the science planning. And I think if any, it'll be one. I can't imagine getting more than one, because if the lifetime of the mission to date, we managed to squeeze three, I don't think we'll be able to get more. And we have other priorities. You know, we had a number of Titan observations. We're now shifting attention to Dione. And so the science planning and series of priorities are complicated. So I don't anticipate that we'll be getting much more data. We might be intentionally or accidentally get one more observation. But in the big picture, this might be the state of knowledge of Enceladus until some future mission.
I'd also like to pose some questions, forward some questions to you from one of our participants who couldn't call in today, from Deirdre Kelligan, writing from Ireland. One, she has four questions, and one, she wants to know, besides the new radio science data, plus previous visual and chemical data, how many other Cassini instruments have added to the evidence for an ocean inside Enceladus?
The biggest instrument is the camera, because an image, you can't beat an action shot of a plume in action. So that is really, and there's actually two different contributions of the camera. One is the image of the plume itself. Another one is the topography field, topography model that we have comes from images. So it's a complicated explanation, but we took a whole series of pictures and we could tell the shape in terms of topography. And that was an essential part of this analysis, to collate the gravity and the topography.
Yeah, I know personally that instruments, the two infrared sensing instruments, VIMS and SIRS on the spacecraft, have also identified thermal anomalies. The higher temperatures one could imagine would be associated with the ocean, which would itself, of course, be warmer than the surrounding ice. And so I think a few instruments have made contributions that are consistent, but this is, I think, is sort of a really strong argument. Let's see. The second question that Deirdre had for you was to, she says that she understands that Enceladus creates and replenishes the E-ring through the shedding of material through the plumes coming out of the Tiger Stripes. To your knowledge, do any of the other Saturnian rings emanate from materials originating from other moons?
I really do not know the answer to that. I read about it, and it seems that some people believe that, but I cannot speak with any authority about it.
As a ring scientist, I can say that the G ring, other rings are associated with other moons, but
yeah,
not in the same way, not in the active shedding of material like plumes, but
smaller rooms get knocked around and material gets thrown off. So there are weak associations, but certainly not with the main ring. Question number three, are there plans to land a
pool? Are you planning to get back to her with the answers? Hmm? Are you planning to get
well,
back?
Well, this will be...
Oh, she'll listen to the recording.
She'll listen to the recording, and these will be posted there. Three, are there
and
plans?
And I just tweeted her your answer.
Okay.
Because she's a frequent volunteer in many of our networks.
Okay, great. Question three, are there plans to land a probe on Enceladus?
I'm not aware of any. I'm aware of a proposal concept where we have dedicated orbiters. In previous, this is public knowledge, previous discovery cycles, some people proposed to land on Titan, boat, you know, so on. I've not heard of any concepts.
That's just mission concepts. It's
yeah.
Quite a different thing than plans.
Oh, yeah.
And number four, will there be a Cassini 2 when our beloved Cassini ends its mission?
Kind of most depressing.
I'll let you answer that.
Because there are certainly no plans for a Cassini 2, so let's hope to get the best out of the mission for the remaining 3 years. I also want to touch back on a point you made. You said that Dave Stevenson was in the comment that doesn't everyone already know about this? I think a lot of people do know, which is why I think we're getting a lot of interest. But I think a lot of people want to know more. I know that just earlier today in Vienna, Luciano gave a similar presentation to a bunch of scientists who are interested. And I know we have Cassini and Enceladus scientists on this very call. So it's really exciting result, and I know that people may know about it, but certainly people want to know a lot more.
And obviously, people know about it through the media. The media did not give them that wonderful equation about spherical harmonics.
Sure.
You can only get that here.
So we still have some more time for follow-up questions from people who are online. If you have them, please.
Hi, I've got a question about a little basic physics here. I noticed that its orbit is very, the eccentricity is very low, and I'm wondering, do orbits in general become more circular as energy from tidal forces is dissipated?
I don't think so.
I believe that they do.
So if all the what is dissipated, all the...
The as the tidal energy gets dissipated...
Yeah, the shape will change.
You tend to want to circularize the orbit.
Okay.
Which is why these non-circular orbits, the ones that have some eccentricity, need to tend to be pumped up by dynamical resonances.
Correct.
Where you find non-zero eccentricities to an orbit, it's telling you that something is probably going on to keep it forced, generally speaking. There are obviously details that are...
There are other effects possible, yeah. Okay.
Okay, thanks.
So I have a question. This is Carly Howitt. I'm on the CS team. If you did get another Enceladus flyby, how much would it reduce the errors of your current maps? I mean, how many would the residuals get? Would the maps significantly change with one, two, three? Like, how many flybys would you need in order to make sort of a better model or a better fit, whatever the right term is?
That's a good question. So if we have, say, one more, I would just estimate, rule of thumb, we might reduce the errors by another 25%. So you'd have a fourth, you know, fourth flyby, and the fourth one would reduce it by a fourth of the error. But the question that we often get, and I don't have a straight answer, is what would be our preference for the closest approach? Would we want to have it somewhere we have not flown before to improve the global picture, or do we want to have it back at the South Pole to see how that has changed as a function of time? So that's kind of a typical debate, and there are advantages to both. Well, that's not settled, so I don't have an answer for that. But I think... the story will not change if we got more flybys, but will just get strengthened as we just keep reducing the errors and improving the SNR of the observations.
As you were talking, I was looking at, I thought there was another RSS flyby towards the end of mission, but I can't find the details, so.
Yeah, I know. I should have looked that up.
I was just trying to do it on the fly and didn't, so okay, thanks.
All right.
Well, I think one thing we didn't really talk about, because it's not quite in the scope, but I know that at the end of the Cassini mission, we're planning on doing something very similar all at once with Saturn itself. And with the in the proximal orbits, I think RSS is hoping to get 6 such flybys of the planet to look at the interior of the planet. I know that'll be interesting. I'm often asked by people, what's the surface like? What's inside Saturn then? And, you know, of course, it has no surface, but I think there's a lot of really interesting science to be gained when we do that. And that'll be interesting. If you want to speak any more about that.
Well, what I want to say is that we spent so much time around the Cassini, around the Saturn system, and the one object we haven't studied in sufficient detail is Saturn itself. So because we're coming very close to these moons by design, and we're studying the moons, but the big planet, to really get the kind of resolution we want to get, you have to come very close, and that's essentially a suicide mission. And so it's appropriate at the end of the mission. So we kind of anticipate like a big breakthrough in our knowledge of Saturn itself and its interior structure. And by coincidence, this will be around the time Juno is doing this exact same type of flybys around Jupiter, so you'll be getting 2 samples of large gaseous planets, and the findings will help explain each other. So it's going to be an exciting period in a couple of years, 3 or 4.
That's what I was going to say.
Well, let me ask, during the proximal missions, when we're close to Saturn, will you be able to tease out the signature of the ring mass as from the Saturn?
I believe so. There's actually been estimates of the mass of the ring material already. And that's been published, I believe.
But those estimates are uncertain by about an order of magnitude.
Yeah, exactly.
My understanding is that we're going to do much better. I think the last I heard was that we were expecting estimates at about 5% of the ring mass, which would be a huge leap forward in ring study. That will really constrain a lot of models.
Exactly, which you can only accomplish by coming close, because now Saturn and the rings are a system, and you're looking at them from a distance. But when you come close, you start distinguishing the effects. All right.
Okay, so if there are no more questions, I'd like to thank our speaker again for a really exciting, really interesting talk, and thanks for the work put into it. And I want to thank everyone else for calling in and participating. We are expecting to have our next CHARM telecon in the summer, when we'll be doing our sort of annual summary of Cassini science. So thanks again, and we will talk to everyone in about 3 months. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.